Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Sengary in for Jane Lindholm. In our attempt to present as many sides of the challenges facing the state's dairy industry as possible, VPR recently hosted a forum we call News and Brews in the Stetson Studio 1 at our Colchester location. The evening pulled together all the stakeholders to discuss the very complicated and delicate issue of dairy and the environment. Over 100 people attended to hear our four speakers answer questions about their particular areas of expertise. VPR investigative reporter Emily Corwin and New England News Collaborative senior reporter John Dillon conducted the interviews with our four guests, whose perspectives range from working on farms to the business side of agriculture, environmental law, and water quality. We begin with Emily Corwin and Jackie Folsom, who is legislative director for the Vermont Farm Bureau and manages the Vermont Farm Show. Jackie and her husband own Crooked Brooks Farm in Cabot, where they milked around 65 cows until about 7 years ago.
You told me earlier that as a child, you really had no intention of marrying a dairy farmer. Can you tell me briefly how it is that you did end up getting into the dairy business?
Truth out, I am a Flatlander, proud to be from Ohio. I'm an Ohio Buckeye. We lived outside of Cleveland, and my husband was a carpenter, building houses in the 1980s. If any of you remember those years, interest rates were like 18-19%. Everybody stopped building houses. And the only job my husband could find was milking cows at a Guernsey farm up the road. And so he was there for a couple years. He was herd manager. We started showing cows. We had a great time. Our kids loved it. And then the farmer decided he didn't want to milk cows anymore. He was getting into draft horses and sugaring. So we cast around and tried to figure out, could we make it a go outside of, we were 26 miles southeast of Cleveland. Property values were starting to go up. They really didn't want another farm there. So we looked around, and my husband had been vacationing in Vermont for years and said, why don't we move to Vermont and start a farm and ship to Cabot Creamery? So we did all that in 1985, and that's how I got here. I knew nothing. I knew nothing about milk checks. I knew nothing about cows. I knew that I hadn't wanted to marry a dairy farmer, but there I was.
Can you talk a little bit about how dairy farming has been in Vermont, and especially with when it comes to profit?
Again, saying that I knew nothing about farming, and we did start, we're 3 miles from Cabot Creamery, so we shipped our milk over there. When we moved up here, we had a mixed herd of cows. We had like three of every kind and a couple that we weren't quite sure what they were. The first year, it wasn't profitable. Like many, many other farm women, I went off to find health insurance. And so I became the bookkeeper at the Cabot School for a couple years, and that worked out very well because it was part-time, and I had two kids in school. And we made a go of it. We got to where my husband had a hernia, and his father decided that he was going to give us our inheritance early. And so we built a brand-new barn down on the other side of the meadow. And we had to walk our cows a half a mile down the road every morning, right along Route 2, 7:30 in the morning, 4:30 at night. It was not fun, but the biggest problem was the traffic. And so every year we had to actually request from the Agency of Transportation permission to walk the cows up and down the road. And one year they said, you know, I don't think this is working out. We're having too many complaints. And I said, complaints? This is iconic. It's Vermont, you know? What could be better than cows in the road? They didn't think that was the thing to do. And so we built the new complex and stopped walking the cows down the road. And at that time, we actually were milking a registered Guernsey herd and shipping a lot of butterfat. If anybody knows anything about milk, that, you know, butterfat was where it was at years ago. And Cabot Creamery really liked the fact that our milk was a single load usually going in to make cottage cheese because of the enriched butterfat out of the milk. And so we got involved in the co-op. We got involved in politics because the AOT came through and decided to buy 20 acres of our farm for the addition of Route 2. And I have to tell you, that started in 1985, and they're just starting the project this summer. So you can see how that works. And I got more involved off the farm because my husband said I was better at talking to people about farming than I was doing it. Never learned. Ruth Town and I share this secret. We never learned to milk a cow, but I could do everything else. And it was profitable. Back then it was profitable. We were, you know, we learned over the years, you have your highs and lows. Toward the end, the lows got deeper and the highs got higher. I remember the year it hit $25 milk and $25 a hundredweight, which is pretty good for milk. And we were paying every bill we had and some ahead because it was just so astonishing to have money. And we were putting it away for the next time the low came, which we knew was coming. So we got out of farming. My husband needed knee surgery and shoulder surgery, comes from farming. And so we sold our beloved Guernseys. That was tough, but we sold them to New York, and they were making ice cream from their milk for a long, long time. We're currently renting our farm out to an organic farmer up the road. So we still do haying. We still feed the cows. That's where we're at. Milking anymore, unfortunately. It was a good life. I learned a lot. I learned to speak out and speak up.
I'd love to know what are some myths that you think the public should know but don't know when it comes to dairy farming.
Myths that they shouldn't believe, I hope.
Sorry, myths you think the public should know the truth about.
Right. One of the myths that people don't understand is that farms are businesses. This has been my mantra for about the last 10 years. We are involved in risk management. We are involved in business planning. Our cows are our industry. Our cows are to us like the computers are to IBM. I mean, we don't abuse them. We take care of them. It's very, very important that we really keep an eye on our expenses and our income. I mean, I still talk to people who say, oh, your dairy farm must have been so sweet. You had like 10 cows up on the hillside. You know, you still get that. Vermont Life has done a wonderful job of promoting our industry and our state, but that is one of the challenges, is that we're not that. We are not like that anymore. Farms are businesses. The other myth I think that needs to be exploded is that we have factory industrial farms here run by millionaires and they're corporations from far away. The farms in Vermont are family farms. They can be LLCs, they can be incorporated. My husband and I, Crooked Brooks Farm, is an LLC because that's what you do when you're running a business. You find the best way to manage your taxes and your finances as possible. And so we were an LLC towards the end of the time. I think people don't also understand how incredibly intelligent the farming community is. It is balancing the feed that cow is eating. It is making sure that you're taking care of where that manure is going. It is doing the taxes so that you know what's coming in and going out. It's working with all the agencies, all the alphabets that you can imagine. So those are the three mythbusters that I would strongly promote as far as anybody speaking about dairy.
One complaint that I've heard is that farmers' stories aren't being told. And I'm wondering if there is a story, an anecdote, that's the kind of thing that you think the public really needs to hear about.
You know, I think one of the real success stories over the last couple years is a program called Breakfast on the Farm. We've had several different farms who have offered to open up their areas for guests to come in, and we've been getting between 1,000 and 2,000 people every year per farm, and we have two farms that offer to do this. One of the farms in the recent past, they did an incoming survey and an exit survey. The question was very pertinent to what we're talking about tonight. How do you think farmers feel about the environment? Do they take care of it? And going in, it was about a 62% response of people saying, yeah, you know, I'm thinking that they do. After they had been to that farm, they had been to all the areas of interest, they had talked to the farmers, they had heard the presentations, they'd petted the calf, they'd petted the cow. The folks coming out of that exit survey said 87% just in 3 hours. Those farmers changed those people's minds. And somebody said to me, well, you know, 1,000 people out of everybody in the state of Vermont. But I would say to you, those are the people that wanted to come to find out what we're doing. And so those are the people that you have to tell, because you're not going to sit in the middle of Chittenden County and hope to tell your story. But you can do it on events like Breakfast on the Farm, and you can do it anytime. There's several organizations that do open farm events. There's mostly in October. That's the way we need to do it. And is it one at a time? Yes, but you tell your stories. And it's not just the farmer owners that are there at the time. There's a variety of farmers who volunteer, and they are all very well spoken.
So this sort of leads me to the next question. The truth is that we wanted to have a farmer who's currently farming sitting in this chair. And we called up a whole bunch of people, and they had so many things to tell us on the phone. and nobody wanted to do what you're doing right now. I think you might have some insight, though, into, you know, why, what's going on. Can you talk about that?
I would be delighted to. You know, I spend time at the State House, too, and actually we had a group of farmers come in today up in Natural Resources, and they were working on the water quality funding bill. And one was a gentleman that's quite well-spoken. He's been up there all the time, and, you know, he went through his thing. And then we had a younger fellow up there, third generation on the farm. And he sat down in his seat, and he said, you know, I'm not an expert at this. I'm not an expert bill reader. And one of the committee members says, well, you know, sometimes we're not either. We never know what's going on. Don't quote me on that one, okay? I have to work there tomorrow. But they said to him, what do you want to talk about? And he started talking about how the things they were trying to do in this bill were going to affect him, positively or adversely. And then he said, nobody wants to come here because there are several media types that have been doing a trash job on farmers lately. You know, why would farmers want to go somewhere when you are told you're doing horrible things and you're not given a fair ride in media? It's a very hard thing for people to sit up here. But I've been talking to folks for a long time. I've been on the education side of agriculture. I've been on the production side of agriculture. I worked for promoting Cabot cheese all over the country. So I know how to talk to people, and I know that for the most part, people want to know about us and our industry, but sometimes when all that is talked about is how bad we're doing and there isn't a balanced effort to try to make sure that they understand that's not the case, it gets very hard for people to get up here. We do have wonderful training programs. I was in one probably 25 years ago. The Milk Promotion Group does a wonderful training program for farmers, and I understand they just had one not too long ago where they put you up and they do, you know, they say, oh my gosh, so you're polluting the water. What do you have to say about that? And they stick a mic right in your face. I remember that because when I took the training, bovine somatotropin, the BST, was the big issue, and I was at, you know, silly little farm girl, here I was. Oh, everybody loves us. Let's just make this fun. And I had a very wonderful person like you, and she was smiling and happy, and she says, okay, Jackie, we're going to start. What do you think about BST? And, you know, when people do that to you and you're not expecting it to be so confrontational, it's really hard.
If there's, you know, one thing that you'd like to see policymakers take action on right now, or to see the people in this room walk away with, is there just one thing you'd like to see happen?
I know there's a lot of farmers in this room. I would like you all to step out of your comfort zone and speak out. For the rest of you who are not farmers, I would like you to go and find one during the break and ask them about what they do for a living and ask them how they're helping the environment, because we are.
That's Vermont Farm Bureau Legislative Director Jackie Folsom with VPR's Emily Corwin. Next, we'll hear John Dillon and Chris Killian, Vice President of the Conservation Law Foundation and Director of its Vermont office. Prior to joining CLF, he worked for the Vermont Natural Resources Council. He's known nationally as an expert on the Clean Water Act, and his professional work in Vermont has focused on Lake Champlain and other polluted waterways. John began by asking about the health of the lake before transitioning to agriculture's role in it.
Full disclosure, I've worked and covered Chris for many years, mainly around water issues. Recently focused, or not so recently, but focused on Lake Champlain. Has there been progress in that regard, in the general health of the lake?
I'd like to say yes, because a no answer on that makes me question my last 15 years. But I think the real progress is this sort of turnout for an event like this and the level of dialogue that is occurring around the major issues that are affecting our lake. And, of course, a lot of focus on phosphorus and eutrophication issues and the conditions that we're now seeing in St. Albans Bay or Missisquoi Bay on an annual basis. And it's not just Lake Champlain. There's a global uptick, massive global uptick in cyanobacteria presence and intensity, waters all over the world, and certainly in New England. So I have a lot of work with colleagues on Cape Cod on eutrophication issues, for example, in the bays around the Cape. We have Lake Carmi as another example. And the fact that through more recent processes and, you know, work through academic institutions and governmental agencies, we are closer and closer, I would say, to having a common understanding of both the issues in the lake and the challenges that we face to address them.
So given that this is a forum about farming and the environment, what's the role of agriculture in the pollution of Lake Champlain?
A lot of folks talk about agriculture as the primary source of phosphorus to Lake Champlain, and Lake Champlain is not just a single water body. It is an amalgamation of water bodies and subsections that influence each other and flow together in different ways. And so it really depends upon where you are in the lake. For example, the broad main portion of the lake off of Burlington, now the largest single source of phosphorus is developed land. It's runoff from pavement and parking lots. And on a per acre basis, that pavement is a more potent contributor of phosphorus and many other pollutants than a farm field or even a barnyard. And so it's not accurate to just sort of point at agriculture and say that's the big problem. And we've taken a lot of heat because we continue to point out the role of wastewater treatment facilities and stormwater infrastructure in municipalities as well. And that's been a real hot button item in Vermont. And there are funding rationales and issues there, but we're just kind of way behind the times dealing with dissolved phosphorus from wastewater treatment plants. And when you look at, for example, the Burlington, Maine facility that discharges right directly into the lake, it's a huge and important contributor of phosphorus there as well. But certainly in Missisquoi Bay, in the Otter Creek watershed draining Addison County, and the area around Lake Carmi, which is not Lake Champlain, but is an important resource to focus on because of the horrible conditions that are present there. Agriculture is, dairy really is the major driver.
And are you focused in your work on a particular size farm, large farms, a particular kind of farm?
I wouldn't say particularly. I would say in the discussions, and I would say productive discussions that we've had with the Agency of Agriculture over the past 6 or 8 years, I would point to an agreement we entered into with the Agency of Agriculture resolving a lawsuit, but a good process ultimately and a good deal. And that agreement focused on milk shippers. But it recognized that there are different scales of farms and tried to come up with timeframes and approaches that were at least somewhat scaled and consistent with the agency's priorities to deal with those differently scaled dairy farms.
The EPA just gave a report card for the state for its progress on meeting the goals that are outlined in the Lake Champlain sort of total phosphorus budget known as TMDL. And it was a pretty good report card. There was a couple of incompletes for last year for funding, but on the other benchmarks, both the Agency of Natural Resources and the Agency of Ag are hitting it. Are you satisfied with that, or do you have an issue with the benchmarks that were used?
Well, this may be a popular or maybe unpopular political cliche right now, but I wouldn't have expected a failing grade from the Trump administration. It's not, I don't want to just be flip, but there is an element of truth there. I think the ultimate language used in the EPA report card was provisionally passed. I say it failed. I say the state failed. And when you look at the failure to move forward to implement the regulatory programs required for large pavement sources, the failure to identify long-term funding for critical agencies like the Agency of Natural Resources and the Agency of Agriculture, and other aspects that we think were sort of boxes that were checked but are, from our perspective, ineffectual programs, we don't see it in that way at all. But in the end, to us, what matters are solutions that actually reduce phosphorus and get that phosphorus out of the lake so we can see recovery. One of the aspects that I feel is very positive in Vermont, there just isn't a strong advocacy voice for saying the lake is just fine the way it is and we shouldn't do anything to correct the problems. This is truly a dialogue that's about people coming together and trying to make tough decisions about restoring a water body that we all care about and we all recognize is in trouble. And I don't think that's been better exemplified in recent years in the significant turnaround in the political posture of the Franklin County delegation in the legislature. And I would point to a few specific people in that regard who honestly were at one time very strong critics of my organization and of me and the advocacy I was doing. And I think the changes that have come about in the condition of Lake Carmi and the condition of the Missisquoi Bay have people that live there, regardless of what they do, seriously concerned. I think that's what we all need to focus on, figuring out how to get this lake back to where it isn't like worse than the one when the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972.
That brings up something because there's also just a recent paper out of University of Vermont Gund Institute where they looked at legacy phosphorus. Years before the Clean Water Act was even conceived, phosphorus was being sequestered into the watershed, and it's built up over almost a century, this thing said. So given that reality, are we putting the burden too much right now on particular pollution sectors? Are we making the farmers pay for that?
I would say no, and not to be Pollyanna, but the changes that we've seen in Shelburne Bay, I think, are a good example, a good indicator of the fact, and maybe not in a necessarily positive light with changes in the land use in that watershed, but
it's cleaner.
It's got, I mean, dramatic improvement in the in-lake concentration and in the conditions in Shelburne Bay as a result of sources being reduced or eliminated, not necessarily through processes that anyone wanted to see happen or support, but in some instances, yes. And the same has been true of wastewater treatment facilities. So the information there with regard to the changes in agriculture and the amount of phosphorus we're importing today in order to support right. conventional ag really are the most important meta message to me, not the fact that we used to dump phosphorus on farm fields when they were grass. One could read that paper as documenting an incredible success story from the perspective of federal agricultural policy. And I don't know that that's really what Vermonters want or need. I mean, with technology and with GMO corn and the kinds of changes in the way we treat and handle and consider high-producing dairy cows, the amount of milk that's being produced out of an animal over a shorter period of time than they used to live, is much more efficient and honestly probably put a lot of people out of work and took a lot of diversity out of our rural economy. And that is really a huge part of what I think we're all struggling with.
I know you grew up in a rural area. I know you worked on farms. Do you have sympathy for their situation now? And what myth, as we asked Jackie, would you like to dispel about your work and CLF's work?
Well, the first myth I would dispel is CLF has never sued a farm, ever. I'm not saying we won't, and maybe we will soon, but there's an awful lot of mythology. We've raised issues and I guess you could say sued. We filed a petition and then challenged a decision of the Secretary of Agriculture that was at a macro policy level about what to do in Missisquoi Bay under the law, but it wasn't directed at any individual farm. It was an attempt to try to bring more rigorous efforts to deal with the phosphorus problem there. So that maybe is the myth. We're trying to find solutions, and we care a great deal about Vermont and the Vermont economy. I grew up working on dairies. The dairies I worked on are gone. We could see three dairies from my folks' house, and they're all gone. And that's tragic. And they were totally different kind of dairies than you generally see today to try to produce milk and sell milk in the way they were selling it. And so I think that's a huge loss. I guess on the sympathy question, I think it's, I don't want to say it's the wrong question. I think that everybody needs to engage on this topic, acknowledge that we can't live with the lake being in the decline it's in. I've said, you know, people went crazy when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, and it's like oft-cited as the reason the Clean Water Act was passed. Lake Carmi might as well be on fire. It's that bad. It is a horrible condition that should not be accepted by any Vermonter in any water body. We have to solve it, and that's what we're focused on, bringing people to the table to solve it.
Thank you.
Chris Killian is Vice President of the Conservation Law Foundation and Director of its Vermont office. You're listening to VPR's News and Brews Forum that took place on Thursday, April 5th, in the Stetson Studio 1 at our Colchester location. The discussions that evening focused on agriculture and the environment in Vermont. Coming up, we'll hear from former Vermont Agriculture Secretary Roger Albee. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Agriculture and the environment are fundamental to Vermont's politics, economy, and daily life. On Thursday, April 5th, VPR held an event that took a deep dive into dairy farming with VPR's investigative reporter Emily Corwin and senior reporter John Dillon. The event was held in our Stetson Studio 1 at our Colchester Studios in 40th and Allen. We explored the stories of local farmers and talked with experts about the culture of farming, the business of agriculture, and its impact on the environment. We've already heard from Jackie Folsom and Chris Killian. The third guest of the night was Roger Albee, who grew up in Brookline on a small hilltop farm. He's worked as a congressional aide on agriculture issues, served as Vermont Agriculture Secretary, and as an international trade negotiator. He has continued his passion for all things farming through his recent policy research on supply management and organic dairying. Let's listen to John Dillon and Roger Albee.
Given what you know and what you've observed over the years, can you give us some insight into the cost of production for a dairy farm and what they're getting paid? And
well, it varies by each farm because they're trying to be as efficient as they can. And it, years ago, the farm credit system used to be do the dairy farm summary. And the question that was always asked, this was the farm credit banks in Springfield when they existed, question was always asked is why is one farmer of the same size profitable and another farmer of a different size, of the same size, not profitable? And it's always management on the farm. But having said that, there is some general trends that come to mind, and that is that the pricing system today, which many people here are part of, is tied to a pricing model that depends upon strengths in international markets. And those international markets are very subject to a lot of disruption. You can imagine what Mexico thinks of us now, our biggest source of exports for dairy products. You can imagine what Asia thinks of us now with the tariffs that are being promoted. So when you depend upon international markets and you have a national model that you're tied into, which our farm sector is today, even in Vermont, you're going to have these dips much deeper, much more prolonged, and lasting longer, and it leads eventually to consolidation of farms and all that that's taking place. You know, what's happened in Vermont with consolidation isn't any different than what's happened nationally with consolidation.
But in terms of what they're getting paid and what their production costs are, is there, it's safe to say there's a differential there?
There's a differential by and large.
Yeah. I want to ask you about this sort of production, overproduction cycle. I've heard it called the backward-bending supplies curve. You get paid less, you need to cover your financial nut, so you produce
well,
more.
Well, in essence, in economics, it means that the individual producer needs to maximize his production and try to lower his cost and increase his profit,
right.
But that's not necessarily good for the industry as a whole.
And then it happens that when prices are good, as Jackie was telling us about, you make more milk potentially,
that's
so you
correct.
Can sock money away. So whatever happens, you're increasing
right.
your production.
Yep.
And you talked about supply management. Why do you think that is an effective system?
Well, I've got a book over there that I collect. The issue of balance in supply and demand has always been an industry desire in the dairy industry and, in fact, other ag production because that basically can lead to some more consistent pricing. A little story in 1982, when Jimmy Carter was running for president as the governor of Georgia. He was up in Minnesota, and a farmer asked him, Mr. Carter, if you're elected, would you support 85% of parity? Parity was a concept that was put in 1949 to provide some stability in basic pricing for the dairy industry. Up until that time, it was about 75% of parity. I think parity today is 75%. I don't know what it would be, but a few years ago, Andy Novakovic said about $50 a hundredweight. He went and said to his aide, Cliff Olsey, who was a friend of mine, what should I say? And he said, say yes. After that, milk came out of the ears. They were storing milk in battleships in New York Harbor and caves in Missouri, and they couldn't get rid of it. They were giving it to school lunch. They were donating it to food programs and other purposes. So when President Reagan was elected, the issue became guns versus butter. There was little choice but to look at what could be done to reduce the oversupply of dairy products that were occurring at the time. So Jim Jeffords, who was on the House Ag Dairy Subcommittee, ranking, and Tom Harkin, then a senator, but at the time the ranking member. We talked to the Canadians, we talked to the Europeans, we talked to everyone we could think of, and we finally decided we needed to do a supply management bill for the U.S. And I remember writing a draft and then sending it to Ledge Council. They got the committee together, members of the committee, and they all agreed there wasn't any alternative to that other than creating a supply management bill. You need to understand on supply management system, those who are growing their milk supply don't necessarily like supply management, but those who have already had the base like it, it leads to more stability in pricing. The committee agreed to it until the representative at that time, this was 1982, of National Milk, the lobbying organization for the dairy cooperatives, came in and said to them, if you do that, you'll never have any support again. All the members, not Jeffords, pointed to Harkin's aide and myself and said, it was their fault. We're not going to do it anymore. But what I'm saying is that the model that exists today is a model tied to international pricing thing that I think is not sustainable for our dairy industry in Vermont. I firmly believe that, because the pricing system really is where you're competing with the West and the Midwest.
You mentioned the co-ops could petition for a change. Tell me about that. How could that happen?
Well, there's a right under the market. There's an ability under the market order for the co-ops to petition the market order administrator. And we believe, I think others may not, but we believe there's some opportunity to bring some balance within supply and demand in the region, because right now it's out of balance. You know, 33% of the milk is fluid today. You know what's happening in the fluid market. It's been going south since 2000. It's decreased by 20%. And the non-dairy beverages, I don't call it milk, but non-dairy beverages are increasing several fold. I think they represent now about 10% of the fluid market. What needs to happen in our dairy industry and in our agriculture in Vermont is that we need to be creative and talk about creating a process where we can be as aggressive in creating a sustainable ag system that addresses aggressively soil and water conservation, all those things, as somebody said, as we were on energy. Why can't we do in that Vermont? In Vermont, we've been known as a leader in the past. Why can't we take that kind of leadership today and not throw gas on each other? I say that because there is that tension sometimes. But put people together that can say, you know, we as a state, we can be creative. It's kind of interesting, John. In the early 2000 period, the Vermont Council of Rural Development did a study on the future of Vermont. It was a community citizen process. I think it was 97% of them said that they wanted a working landscape, higher than health care. Well, I can't believe that, but higher than health care. Nobody asked the cost, but it was higher than health care. I bet if you had the same people in the room, they would say, we want good soil, we want good water quality, and we want a working landscape. So how can we put all those values together in a sustainable way and say, Vermont's going to be a leader, we're going to be a leader in the future, and we understand that our farmers can't live under this arcane pricing system that exists today. So let's create the leadership to figure something out.
Thank you.
That's former Vermont Agriculture Secretary Roger Albee with VPR's John Dillon. Coming up, we'll hear from our final guest, Joshua Faulkner, an agricultural engineer with UVM Extension. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Today we're hearing interviews from a recent event at VPR that explored the connection between dairy and the environment in Vermont. Our final guest of the evening was Joshua Faulkner, an agricultural engineer with UVM Extension, where he leads the program on farming and climate change. His PhD research at Cornell focused on the relationship between agriculture and water quality on New York dairy farms. He was interviewed by VPR's Emily Corwin.
So tell us a little bit about the farm that you grew up on in West Virginia and, you know, how that may have played into your, you know, doing what you do today.
I grew up on a dairy farm that had gone out of business and had transitioned to beef production. We had anywhere between 50 and 75 cows, ran a small cow-calf operation, but that experience being on the farm just really drove me into a profession where I could interact with farmers in an extension way, but also use farming to better the environment, to understand that deep connection there. There's such a strong understanding, I think, of farmers, of how nature operates. It's very few people, I think, that work that closely with the earth, and they manage ecosystems. So I wanted to work in a field where I could interact at that interface between the managed and unmanaged environment.
You did your research in New York. You grew up on a farm in West Virginia. Do these experiences in other places, have they given you any sort of special insight into where we're at now here in Vermont?
Yeah, so I would say a couple of things, and in no way want to belittle the issues we have with water quality here, but I think in some ways we're so fortunate that we still have a dominant agriculture in Vermont that is an integrated agriculture, that we still have crops and animals on farms, that we haven't disconnected those types of farming systems like they have in the Midwest. I think that's one thing I see here that I did not see elsewhere.
You mean the feed? And
exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right. We still can produce a good amount of forage on our farms here in Vermont. You know, I grew up just outside of the coal fields in southern Appalachia. We were one of the only operating farms around. And again, not to belittle problems here with water quality, but it's a whole different scale. So it kind of puts things in context when you see missing mountains and cancer clusters and the extreme issues that come along with that industry and water quality in that part of the country.
In hearing John Dillon talking with Chris Killian, he mentioned that Lake Carmine might as well be on fire, that the situation with water quality is at a crisis point. Do you share that sentiment?
I may be in a minority, but I'm really optimistic about the future. I'm really bullish on the future. And you know, I work with climate change on climate change issues and water management issues. But I think that we're at this point in Vermont agriculture where there's almost this kind of revolution where we're starting to understand how important soil health is, how important certain management practices are, like cover crops, like no-till. We're starting to see that those just catch on like wildfire. And yeah, we have water quality issues, and a lot of that is that legacy phosphorus. But we're really starting to turn the ship, I think, right now in Vermont and use these other practices. We're going to be one of the only places in the country, I feel like, in the future that has water. This is such a key resource. The rest of the country is going to be water deficient. And I think that creates an opportunity for us. And I think it's optimistic for the future of agriculture in Vermont.
And you work in this critical sort of nexus between concern for environmental health and concern for agricultural sustainability. And I wonder if you have insights that you can share with us from that perspective.
The one thing I would say is that water quality and agriculture have a really complicated relationship, and there's a lot of things we don't yet understand, and there's a lot of complex feedback loops. And one of the things that I see is that with drainage of any kind, we can all of a sudden take advantage of some of these conservation practices like cover crops and no-till. Seeing those complexities, I think, is unique in the sense of, you know, not just on the ag side and not just on the environmental side.
You can't help but getting into it. I want to push us further down this road. Is your work in understanding and anticipating what climate change has already meant for Vermont farmers and what it could mean in the future. I'm interested to hear both sort of the scary parts and the hopeful parts there. So let's start with the scary and end on the hopeful note.
Yeah, that's best. Okay, so So the scary parts. I mean, the story for Vermont in terms of climate change, story for Vermont agriculture in terms of climate change, is really changes in moisture regimes. We're seeing increases of up to 9 inches a year in annual rainfall over the past 30 years in some parts of the state. That's really difficult for farmers to deal with. We're also seeing this 75% increase in extreme events. So, you know, anecdotally, I'm sure most people can attest to that. We've seen this happen. These are really difficult for farms. These are difficult for natural resource management and for agricultural systems. Those are some of the scary things. I think those are probably the two most concerning of what climate change is going to bring our way. And that really affects feed production. We're not yet to the point where we have to worry about warming temperatures and heat stress for dairy cattle as much as some of our states to the south. But these are kind of the top of the list for concerns on the dairy farm. In terms of opportunities, like I said, I think we will have water. We will have water in the future. And we need to learn how to manage and exist sustainably within our environmental boundaries here and take advantage of the water that we are going to have in the future. But knowing that we are going to have water, I think, is really comforting moving forward into the future. We'll have adequate supplies of water. I also think we're seeing it in California. We're seeing farmers and carbon trading type schemes develop where farmers are able to build carbon in their soil, decrease greenhouse gas emissions, and generate payments for the farm. So I think that as we see these markets develop, this could be an opportunity for Vermont farmers, and especially those farmers with the largest acreage or conventional dairy farmers.
How does that work?
As we do specific practices like these best management practices, we tend to build organic matter in the soil, which carbon is the prime constituent of organic matter. And then, say in California, that would give that farmer a carbon credit and a payment would be made. We're not to a point where we have a market like that in Vermont, but it's really exciting. I think it's exciting for dairy farmers to think about the potential for a market like that to develop. The budget is tight on the farm, so an additional source of revenue would be very welcome.
Are there myths you want to explode that you think, you know, one person or another in the sort of farming environmental community should understand?
The one that I see the most is that for some reason people think farming is simple, you know, and it's not. It's so complex. I mean, I have a PhD in engineering, and I can't do what they do. I mean, it is so complicated to conceive of everything that happens on the farm. And so I would just want the public to understand that. And we heard it earlier. Just we need more conversation with the public, with farmers. You know, we need them to get to know their trials, their struggles. You know, they were dealing with climate change long before I think we even recognized climate change was occurring. They were adapting, and that is farming, though. But and there's so many challenges, and it's very complicated.
And are there things that you have seen and understood about what, you know, regulations and policies that are in place in Vermont, some of them are newer, how they're impacting farmers that you think the public and the people writing those policies should understand?
Nothing that I can identify immediately. I mean, certainly the Act 64, the required agricultural practices. Before, I think it was medium and larger farms were dealing with regulation, and so this is really new to our small farming community, and I hear about that a lot. As anyone who's on small farms hears about that a lot. You know, we're still kind of in this learning stage of learning how we're going to meet those regulations. What new practices are for small farms? They haven't received the level of financial and technical assistance and education that some of our medium and larger farms have. So I think we're in this learning phase with our small farms and that regulation.
Okay, got it. Well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
That's UVM Extension agricultural engineer Joshua Faulkner with VPR's Emily Corwin appearing at a recent News and Brews event that we hosted in the Stetson Studio 1 at VPR's Colchester Studio.